This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Rene Fink was born to Jewish parents in the Netherlands just a couple of years before the start of World War II. When the Germans invaded Holland in 1940, life didn't result in sudden changes. Instead, the limits on the freedom of Jews were incremental. First, her family was forced to leave their seaside home and move further inland. Soon, Jews could only shop at certain hours, were banned from public parks, and not allowed to practice their professions. As the restrictions and the dangers began to mount, the decision was made to find a safe home for Renee. She was smuggled away by members of the underground who placed her with a new family. She survived. Her parents were not so lucky. Today, she devotes her time to telling her story. She's part of the Holocaust Speakers Bureau and joins us now on the State of Things. Renee Fink, welcome.
Thank you, Frank. It's a pleasure to be invited by you.
It's good to have you here and hear your story. When you were born, your family was living in a seaside town in Holland, right? What do you know about that town?
It was a wonderful seaside town. People go there on vacation. But as the war began in Holland, Jews had to move inland. They were not trusted. They might send signals if they were at the shore. And so we were forced inland as all alien Jews. My parents had not become citizens of the Netherlands. So we went to another town.
And where were they from?
They originally, when they fled Germany, they were living in Breslau. Mm-hmm. Breslau is now in Poland.
Right. So first they fled, then they're in, and now they're forced. They're not really fleeing for their safety at this moment. They're actually forced off the
Correct.
Coast inland, and they find a new home.
Mm-hmm.
So and talk about that situation, because it wasn't long after that that even that wasn't safe enough, right?
It wasn't a matter of, well, we were forced inland the first time. The second time, as 1942 approached. Jews had to find either a hiding place or be prepared to be taken in raids that we called razzias in Holland. I refer to Holland, which is technically, the correct name is the Netherlands or the Kingdom of the Netherlands. But Holland is so much faster and easier to say. In 1942, you were either taken to Westerbork, which was a transit camp on the way to the death camps, or you made yourself disappear. And with the help of the underground, which we called it the underground in Holland, but it's better known in a larger sense as the resistance.
Mm-hmm. And that resistance movement, I mean, it's not, it just wasn't safe to move and hide whole families, so.
True. Sometimes mothers went with their children. My parents went to hide on a houseboat in one area, and I, being an only child, went alone to a family. I didn't know why. People didn't talk for two reasons. Children were not thought of necessarily as sentient beings in the way we are now. We were children. But most important, there were no, there were secrets and knowledge was dangerous. And so nothing was explained to me. And it might have been too upsetting.
Well, you were 4 years old at the time. What do you remember about that whole episode, about your separation and your placement?
I remember this is not a memory. I think in my adult life that my parents were examples of the ultimate courage and the ultimate love in giving me up. And as a child, I didn't know anything beyond my immediate comfort, and I didn't know why I was going with a stranger on her bicycle. Or where I was going, or how long it took, or what. We were expected to be well-behaved and quiet.
You were placed with a family. Tell us about that family.
The family. As an only child, and also very, very shy, which I am to this day. People don't believe it. But suddenly, I found myself in what at the time seemed like an enormous house. I've been back there. There's nothing enormous about it, but to a four-year-old's eyes, the people who came one at a time, who were my new sisters and brothers, all looked like giants. They were big-boned. They were very different from my tiny bones and my very dark hair and eyes. They were maybe not totally blonde, but they were blondish, larger. And they were all older. And I was very homesick, I think. So I didn't speak. I lost my appetite, which is stupid in retrospect, because soon enough, when I got my appetite back, there wasn't a lot of food to eat. But at that time, we still had food. And the father, who was so severe and strict, whose children were quite frightened of him for good reason.
Eight of them, right?
All eight of them. There's an interesting story about the eight of them plus me, the ninth. He babied me. He was loving towards me. He fed me with his hands. He encouraged me to eat. And I had nothing but love for this man. And for my siblings.
And you said he's a pretty stern taskmaster, and they all kind of took that in. But in your case, there he is doing the nurturing. As you said, knowledge is dangerous, and it's particularly dangerous if you tell children because they'll have to keep a terrible secret. How much did you know about what was happening to you when you were four?
Oh, I knew nothing. Absolutely nothing. And so I always thought I was very lucky, because anyone who's older would be fearful because it was a time beyond description in terms of fear. I picked up the fear around me. You absorb it. You know what is going on an emotional level without the facts. And the boys in the house were very fearful. And the father also, I also got punished, which is wonderful because I was completely equal to all the children.
What would you do to get punished?
I don't remember doing anything wrong. I mean, all little Jewish children who were hidden by families or in barns or wherever they were very well behaved because some part of us, it was the time, but I think some part of us somehow felt that we had to behave better. We could be out on the street.
You were with the family. They were, of course, taking a risk. And you talked about the number and why that's interesting, because the Germans had a very strict count. They knew what they were looking for, right?
They knew what they were looking for, except on all the other raids to the house. They were searching for Jews. They had raids in the cities on homes in Jewish quarters, and they took Jews on trucks and took them away. But in my little town where I was hiding, they went from house to house also looking for Jews. And at other times, Germans came and they just raided houses. I don't know if they were always looking for Jews, in this case, me, or if they were looking for an extra blanket or a radio. You could get into very big trouble. They could shoot you on the spot if they were so inclined. If you had a radio, it was all forbidden. In the end, they took whatever they wanted from the house. So we were colder and hungrier.
And they knew there was a count. So there were eight children in that family. And if they came in, there needed to be eight kids and not any more. And now you are one extra. So how did the family manage that? Because there were raids on that house, right?
There were frequent raids. And I remember not so directly, but one of my sisters told me later in life, I have been in touch with the family and I am still part of it. She told me that she would be sent, out on the street to make up an excuse if she was questioned by soldiers, that she was out visiting her aunt, doing whatever sounded reasonable, so that there would be still three girls in the house. They took chances to keep me alive at the risk of every one of their lives, every day until the end of the war. Those are words, but the concept is something so incredible.
We're going to talk more about that, about how you learned to understand what you and they had been through as you matured and found your way to Chapel Hill eventually. Renee Fink, Jewish Holocaust survivor, current resident of Chapel Hill and a speaker with the Holocaust Speakers Bureau. We'll talk more about her journey and what it means to her today. We'll talk about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Renee Fink, who has had many names and many identities over the course of her life. She was born in the Netherlands to a Jewish family just 2 years before the start of World War II. She spent a few short years with her birth family before being sent into hiding. Today, Renee lives in Chapel Hill. She spends much of her time sharing her story to ensure the memory of the Holocaust lives on. Let's talk more about the Vandenbrink family that you lived with and your time there. How much did you know or dare ask about your parents in this period?
I love the question, but the answer is rather stupid. I don't think I asked because you didn't raise issues, you didn't raise questions. And little by little, I grew so accustomed that I loved everybody in this family.
I don't think it's stupid at all. I think we can understand that you take on as a child, you realize these subjects are off limits. I can't go there.
They were off limits.
The danger of this. This is even a four-year-old, I would
yes,
think. Yes. Or perhaps especially a four-year-old.
An implicit understanding mm-hmm. somehow.
Did you learn about what happened to your parents and when did you hear?
After the war, the dancing in the street lasted for an hour or so. Mm-hmm. And then we woke up the next morning and it was devastation. And after the war, things were really bad. But eventually, my grandmother and I reunited. We went to live in an odd little house with toadstools growing all over my bedroom walls. It was very damp. As soon as I was with my grandmother, I began to ask when my parents were coming back. There were no answers, and I continued to ask. And consistently, there were no answers. And at some point, a child gets the message, and I stopped asking. No information was ever, ever offered. And I found out from my oldest Catholic sister, I differentiate the Vandenbrink family as my Catholic family, mm-hmm. And she told me, and I also found out in a book. But it was so disturbing that I forgot about it. And on some level, I never knew what happened to my parents.
It's your grandmother, as you say, was very important to you, especially in this transition. Tell us more about her, because she was an interesting figure and certainly an important figure to you.
I know I'm on the radio. People cannot see that I'm smiling, but when my grandmother's name or just her image comes up, I smile because she was greater and better and more of everything good. And I loved going to live with her, and I would have been happy if we could always have stayed together. She was born in 1884. She was a very, not highly educated, because she had to, as the oldest child without a father and a sick mother and a sick sister, she was running the family. And she was very good later in life at managing three children in this German mega inflation. These were very bad times in Germany before the outbreak of the war. And those times in part led to the war. Mm-hmm. And she always managed to get food and to keep her children warm and fed. And after the war, when she came to Holland, she learned Dutch. When she came to America later on, she learned English. She adapted, and she was a progressive woman.
And a woman who had educated herself in the concerns of high culture. She knew
yes.
literature, she knew music, and she loved to share that with you.
All of it.
Yeah.
And I would ask her, why, how do you know this is a good material if you touch a piece of cloth? How do you know this is a great conductor? Or, you know, ask her all these things because she knew.
You lived with her for a while in Europe, but then eventually moved to with her. Did the two of you move together to America?
My grandmother had no funds. Mm. She lived through the First World War and the Second World War. And even though she had a house full of servants, not because she was wealthy, but people, middle class people, had help in those days. And she had a little more help because she went to work, which was already very avant-garde and advanced. Mm. After the war, she was left without funds. We could not live together. It was just a logistical issue. There was no rent, no money. So I went to live with a cousin of my mother's who had come with her husband, and her father came shortly after to the United States after medical school in the late 30s. And so they established their medical practices and they lived in the mountains. And I went to live with them.
In the Adirondack Mountains in the U.S. now we're talking about.
In New York.
I want to talk more about that, but I don't want to leave this idea of the economic hardships, because we can certainly focus on the political and social hardships and horrors that are brought about by ultranationalism that we saw flare in that part of the 20th century and perhaps again today. But I don't think perhaps we know enough about the economic hardships. Even your family, the Vandenbrinks, who took you in, were suffering horribly during the war themselves.
The father was more clever than I ever imagined. I said, I want to live on a farm, and I lived with farmers. Meanwhile, I called the mama and papa. He had brick factories in Belgium. And he was a fruit farmer, but he had varied interests, and he did great, wonderful works, and he was a man of principle, first and most.
Even so, it couldn't stop the family from ultimately. I mean, at a time you said you could share bread with neighbors and people who came to the door, and even that had to stop at a certain point.
That it's all correct. We had chickens, and we had one pig. We had a barn, but the barn was for the boys to hide in from the Germans so that they were the age of conscription. And the pig had to be kept a secret, especially when we slaughtered it. It was slaughtered at night undercover so no one could hear squealing. I fed chickens, but this was all at the outset of the war, and little by little, our food sources dried up, and Holland had the famous hunger winter. It was the coldest winter, and it was where the food supplies absolutely dried up. And at some point, we ran out of dandelion greens. We ran out of all the things people were eating, and it was a very difficult day when there were knocks at the back door with people begging for food. And my oldest sister, Zeus, had always given them very quietly. Nothing was ever said. They did not do it for gratitude or for any hoopla. But she didn't jump up. She didn't answer the door, because really we were down to eating flour and water, flour mixed with water, and tulip bulbs. So we were hungry and we were cold.
So that, and that is your survival. That's your hiding place. That's the best situation that you could have found under those circumstances. As you say, eventually the war did end. You found your way to the United States, living in the Adirondacks with extended family. And that was not a good time for you.
I was no longer an equal in any household after the war. So I can tell you unequivocally that my earliest years with my parents, plus all the war years, were my absolute happiest childhood years. And this is true for many child survivors. And this is what is so relevant, I think, about the fact that war continues and there is a world full of survivors in Africa, in Asia, in parts of Europe, with traumatized people walking around, having children. There's even a new science, and I can't remember the name, that you pass the trauma on. And we keep doing this, and people are not picking up on the signs that are very clear.
What were the signs for you? You're talking about some of the epigenetic changes.
Epigenetic changes.
And that can
that's the word.
That the genes you pass on, that you can create, or in a sense create changes in your own genetic makeup that you pass on, that you did not inherit, that you developed culturally or because of your current situation.
This is the new science, which at first sounded very hokey to me, but it is a science. And I, just for one tiny example, don't know what I have passed on to my children. But in some way, they don't fit in like the normal children who had the white picket fences and the... We were a happy family. We were a wholesome family. But somehow we were not like other families.
Well, tell us more about that time in the Adirondacks, because that was not a happy time for you. And as you say, you really didn't feel accepted.
I didn't feel accepted there. And I, at some point, I don't remember the nitty-gritty of my... escapes, but I did manage to run away a lot. I would run. I had one. My surviving family, my close biological surviving family, consisted of my grandmother, and I never really got to see her. And my mother's sister, my aunt, she tried to maintain a house in New York City. So I would run away on the Trailways bus in New York State. I got to know all the drivers because I took this trip often enough, so they greeted me like an old friend. But it wasn't really a happy situation. Oh. So I don't remember packing my bag or making arrangements, but I went back and forth between the two families, not being able to find peace in either place. They each had one child of their own. And I have to say that my survival was an inconvenience and a very sad reminder that I survived to those where I tried to live. And they were very unhappy years.
What do you suppose that was? Perhaps this is a little unfair to them to some degree, but what do you suppose it was that someone who had been through that horrible trauma, one that was inflicted on their extended family, they couldn't seem to accept you? Did you represent something to them they didn't want to face? What
I
was that,
don't know do if think? I represented something they would rather not remember for those, my aunt who was there. My aunt, who, by the way, told my daughter, unbeknownst to me, when I, obviously I was a married woman later in life who had a daughter who was already a little older, and my aunt said to her about me, nothing happened to her. She was little and she was protected. This, by the way, was a rather common refrain for adults. They were so traumatized personally that they could only slough everything else off, and it was easier to cope if they could honestly think that nothing ever happened to me.
You did manage to make your way through that and ultimately go to college, right? You went to Vermont.
I went to the University of Vermont. I was kind of dumped on the street. Their own daughter was all important, and she wasn't that happy that I came into her only child life when she was eight. And she went to Cornell, and they had to bring her for orientation and be there for her. So a couple of weeks before my college began, they left me on the street with all my belongings. But, you know, I turned that into something positive. It happened to be next to a fraternity house.
And okay, so you could,
I got a little head start in all the fraternity boys. And it was a Jewish fraternity, no less. Helped me move into the dorm, and all the other girls moving into the dorm were already threatened by me.
What were you expecting to do now? You're going to go to college? What were you imagining?
I was imagining they would find that I was an imposter. I had this imposter syndrome, that they accepted me because they made a huge mistake. I wasn't a student, and I was told on a daily basis that not everybody is college material and that I was rather stupid. Only intelligent people play bridge. I couldn't learn to play bridge, so I shouldn't even try. I went to college and was convinced within a month they would find out how stupid I was and they'd throw me out. So, okay, I lasted through the first year. I made Dean's List, and then I called my family and said, I am not going back. So from the age of 19... I supported myself. I lived in a room in Queens, New York, a furnished room with kitchen and bath privileges. I went to a full-time job in Manhattan.
What were you doing?
I was a secretary for public relations, a very small firm and a big, big office building, a very famous location. And I had a very decent boss. And then I went to night school in Brooklyn. And it was a very rigorous existence. I was terribly alone in the world and just feeling lonely. But I did have a boyfriend. Again, I had many. And we married. And so...
You have said that your husband, Edward, has really, really set you on a new trajectory. Is that right?
Yes, and that's when I don't think people who are 20 and 21 years old necessarily understand the difference between infatuation and deep abiding love, and maybe no one at any age does, but we took a chance on each other, and it was the most wonderful, most healthful love. He believed in me. He took me as I was, and he'd had a pretty sketchy and dicey childhood, too. His mother was ill. And so we really needed each other, and it was a fantasy. We each had a fantasy, and we somehow lived it out.
Well, I was going to say, the dream came true. How did it change things for you? Where did it set you?
I was accepted. I was loved. And I had only known that from my grandmother, you know, after the war. The Van de Brinks were a loving family, but not in a demonstrative way. Mm. One night, the father got up and tapped each child on top of his, her head. He went around the whole table. And one of my brothers was outraged. That was the only time Papa had touched any of us. So... to have that kind of love.
We'll talk about the fruition of that love when Renee Fink comes back on our program. We're going to continue our conversation. A Jewish Holocaust survivor, current resident of Chapel Hill, part of the Holocaust Speakers Bureau. We'll talk more about that as well on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking to Renee Fink, Holocaust survivor, born in Holland just before the onset of World War II, made her way to the U.S., fell in love, married, and ultimately had two kids. Talk about your life, and also came to Chapel Hill. What brought you here?
Oh, what brought us, my husband and me, to Chapel Hill is rather bizarre. We lived in a little corner of southwest rural Virginia, and one day my husband said, "We have to go to Chapel Hill. You have to find a dress for our daughter's wedding." And I said, "Are you crazy? I thought it was on the other side of the planet." But we drove into Chapel Hill, and something took hold of me, and I screamed at him, "This is where we have to spend the rest of our lives." There was a feeling. You cannot describe it. Somehow, it was a gut-wrenching response. And we were still in the car, but I don't know what it was. And then we got out of the car, and it just grew. And I thought, this is where we have to live.
Well, what was he doing at the time?
Poor man said okay, but he thought of it in terms of the future.
Well, talk about his job. Talk about before we get there, because that's fascinating. And then when your wife does this to you in your car, and you're saying, "Well, I have this other home we're living in," but he was doing what? He was doing importing, right?
He was importing hardware for the furniture industry, and so he thought it would behoove us to live in the center of the furniture
North
industry,
Carolina,
and well, that was Virginia.
Yeah, but I'm
and
saying,
was,
oh,
but
oh.
This whole region was rich in furniture. That was a town called Martinsville, Virginia, mm-hmm. and there were a great many furniture factories there. So, Chapel Hill was another story. Meanwhile, his business had an address and a location, and we had a building, and we had bought a house and made a home there. So he, for me to say it is one thing, but for him to enact all that is quite another thing. And I understood that it wasn't so easy as my words. But little by little, we managed it. It was a very difficult move. And I kept saying the most worthwhile things in life can be very difficult.
What was hard about it?
We had to sell our home and our business building. Hmm. The building didn't sell so quickly and easily. We had to build a building here in Chatham County. And the business is still there. My husband died in 2003, but my son is running it. Put up that building, build a house, and it was a difficult move.
And what were you doing all this while? You're raising the kids, but obviously one of them
the kids
married.
Were grown.
They were gone by then, right?
Yeah. They were gone. They were neither one was married, but marriage was not that far in the distance. Mm.
So you re-entered the workforce, right?
Yes.
Got to learn some typing skills and a few
things. I did that in New Jersey before 1984, mm-hmm. before we moved south. But at that point, when we moved here, I helped my husband with the business. I had been working in New Jersey for some years. And I trained with hospice, and I did various things.
Up until this time, you had not really been telling your whole story, the story of the Holocaust. Let me talk about that. Was it anything that you, at any point along the line, thought you should be doing or ever compelled to do, ever asked to do?
I spent a lot of my energy denying that I was in a war, that I survived, what happened to my family, why was I alone? So much energy was spent on that. And then in 1991, some New York Hidden Children got together and decided that they would have a gathering. This gathering became a gathering of 1,600. I didn't want to say 1,600 in case someone misunderstands it for less, fewer people. 1,600 came from all over the world. They had all been hidden in one fashion or another. My hiding was the best kind. Mm. I was among the fortunate ones. And we talked about it, and you know, they had first aid stations. This took place in the Marriott Marquis in Manhattan. It had to be a very large hotel. First aid stations did not consist of doctors and Band-Aids. They were peopled by psychiatrists. Mm-hmm. They didn't know how many people would fall apart after all the silence. And that is the turning point in my entire life. We were charged with the mission being the last surviving generation to witness the Holocaust. We were charged with this mission of having to speak about it so it wouldn't be forgotten, so we could learn from history. And I don't know what we've learned from history, but suddenly I was charged with this mission, and my whole life was upended from the way it had been.
It's fascinating to think about this. As you say, there was actually first aid stations staffed with psychiatrists in preparation for this meeting, right? Which is to say that many of the people who came felt the same way you did. They had not spoken about this, but were somehow compelled to go to this thing. What drove, if you had been silent and, as you say, spent so much energy denying it to yourself, why did you decide to go to this?
I didn't even know directly. And I had never told even my children what happened to me in my childhood. They knew nothing from me. Whatever they knew, my husband told them. And for one thing, our son never wanted to ask me questions. He didn't want to make me unhappy. And children of survivors have special, they feel a sense of obligation not to upset the parents, which is a burden they should never have to carry. And I forgot your question.
Well, so then ultimately, if you denied this to yourself for so long, and then you see an ad for the Hidden Children of the Holocaust.
Oh, what got me there. Yes, someone sent me this little ad in the mail, snail mail, and it was a tiny cutout clipping from a Jewish newspaper that there would be this gathering. And my husband and I looked at each other and said, well, I don't have a choice. I have to go to this. This is what I am. There was no name for people like me. I didn't know this happened to anyone else in the world. So it was one of the biggest things that could have happened.
What kind of stories were you hearing when you got there? As you say, you were taken in by a family. You had, you know, protection.
I was in an actual house. And I was hearing from children who were quite hysterical. And I remember a child, I mean, we were all children within quotation marks, who had been hiding in the sewer system of one of the Polish cities, and she had one little rag of clothing. She kept it. It might be in the Holocaust Memorial Museum. That struck me as just the most terrible. Others were on the run. There were all kinds of hidden children. My kind of hiding was pretty cushy. I mean, of course it wasn't. We were infested with vermin and sties and everything, and we were hungry. But it was one of the cushiest, and there were children running around in Eastern Europe as feral children in the woods. There were children hidden in haylofts and barns, in chicken coops. I had a friend who was in a chicken coop. And hiding like the famous Anne Frank, yeah, who was in a whole apartment, but not so big. And they couldn't move in the daytime because the floor might squeak up.
What was it like for you after all these years of silence to be in the midst of so many people sharing their story in some ways similar to yours?
I felt so many feelings. For one thing, the first night of each conference, we gather with our country in a room. So all the Dutch people went to one room. They all began speaking Dutch. Then I thought, you know, I never belonged in America. Now I don't even belong with my fellow Dutch child survivors or hidden children because I don't know what they're saying. I lost the language. And a remarkable man came over and he noticed that I was a little lost, little by little. And he was the founder of the Anne Frank Society. There's even a movie made about him, and he was wonderful, and he made me more comfortable. He little by little gathered the name of some other people in Chapel Hill, and we've been friends ever since.
Now a member of the Holocaust Speakers Bureau. Talk about what you do and why you think it's so important.
So I speak, and I feel compelled not to turn any requests down. I began many years ago, even before the Holocaust Speakers Bureau, with a particular teacher in one Durham middle school. And these were young children. I just had to tell the story, had to make people aware of how evil and ugly war is. And it was never about me. I don't want to focus on me. And this whole hour with you, talking with you, is a pleasure, but the focus on me feels somehow not quite correct. It was to enlighten people about the signs, and we are living in the midst of so many of these danger signs today. So it was to remember war, to bring home to younger children, also adults, and I've spoken at universities, high schools, and clubs, organizations, churches, just the ugliness.
What are some of those signs that you see today?
Before Trump was elected, I could see clearly the handwriting was on the wall about his xenophobia, his narcissism. There was a seeming prejudice of the other, whether we come from Mexico, no matter where we come from, the nationalism, the white supremacy, that America first. This country of America is nothing but a group of immigrants, except for the Native Americans. This is what has made this country so rich. Unlike the totally homogeneous societies, we've had more creativity, more of everything that's good from this rich immigrant mixture. Mr. Trump was clearly putting an end to all that. When the thing happened in Charlottesville, Virginia, and he said there are good people on both sides, I got quite sick because what can you say after that? That kind of says it all. When he's calling Nazis good people.
And we have forgotten, it seems to me. You have some startling statistics about what we don't know and what we don't remember about the Holocaust.
When it's alarming when you think that 10% of Americans have never heard of the Holocaust, are unfamiliar with the word. I have one friend who thought it was a kind of food group. She was a college professor, so she created a Holocaust teaching. I don't
like
know.
Like a curriculum that you have.
She created a curriculum around teaching Holocaust at her college.
And you've helped to develop a curriculum yourself.
I didn't help develop it, but the North Carolina Council on the Holocaust, namely Marianne Wason, created this magnificent text. It says, The Holocaust, a North Carolina Teacher's Resource. And it features the narratives of Holocaust survivors who became North Carolina residents. So it makes it very human for students to work with this book.
Do you think knowing about this does make a difference? When you think about the fear and the anxiety that has developed this infection that we have in the United States now, we've got camps at our border. We're separating children from their families in the name of the United States of America. Does knowing about this going to make any difference, or is the fear and anxiety too deep?
I am so hoping that as we hear more and more about the separation of children, I don't know how many thousands, some die. We hear about the few who have died in custody. They are being separated from their parents and not being, this is not America. This is a very dangerous country as we know it today. And we have got to get out of this mindset very quickly. It's an emergency, as is climate change. I mean, our country is in dire straits.
Renee Fink, thank you so much for sharing all of this with us today. What a pleasure to talk with you. Renee Fink, Jewish Holocaust survivor, current resident of Chapel Hill, part of the Holocaust Speakers Bureau, and you can find out more about her and her work at our website, stateofthings.org. Movies on the Radio, speaking of the environment, what's your favorite film about the environment? Email us at sot@wnc.org. State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, with Robin Copley as our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.